All right, again, I am grateful to be here today. It's kind of interesting, the lesson that Josh shared with you gave us one side of God, God of comfort, and it was very good and very applicable today. I'm going to bring a lesson in the 11 o'clock hour on the 29th Psalm, which describes God's power and what he is capable of. And so it's another side of it, indicating, of course, God's judgment and other things, but his might and his glory. And so we'll see another aspect of God in that discussion. Here in Acts chapter 24, we're going to be seeing, unfortunately, the character of men. And when we talk about the character of men, we see today, for example, that we cannot place a great deal of trust in our political leaders and our judicial leaders and societal leaders in general. It seems like things get more and more corrupt. If you were to ask in a survey, do you have confidence in the president? Most will say no. But the interesting thing about it, while there are so many political leaders in, for example, the House or the Senate that are critical of the president, if you have the same survey, the question is asked, what is your trust factor with regard to your congressman? It's even lower than it is for the president. And that's, of course, the Supreme Court is suffering as well from partisanship and from the perception of partisanship. And all of those kinds of things are present in our society. But the fact is that 2,000 years ago, it wasn't much different. And we're going to see that it's not much different, both with regard to the Jews as well as with the Roman governor, as we look here in the 24th chapter. Very interesting study that we're going to be in. But let's note again what happened in chapter 23. We'll note, first of all, that it was in that 23rd chapter that Paul was arrested. He was initially taken by the Roman commander, Lysias, to the Sanhedrin to be made aware of the charges against him. But with regard to that, they were plotting and they were striving to kill him. And in the middle part of the chapter, there's actually a plot that is described with regard to some of the Jewish zealots who wanted to do the bidding of the Sanhedrin and covenanted with them and made a vow that they wouldn't eat or drink until they had killed Paul, which didn't happen. So I don't know if they starved or died of thirst, but the fact is they were not able to accomplish this. But this plot was entered into to kill Paul, and basically the Romans took care of Paul. They not only took care of him while he was there in Jerusalem, but they afforded his, wouldn't say escape, but his transfer to the Praetorium in Caesarea, where Felix was governing the region. To get him further away from the Jewish mob. Now, the Sanhedrin was told to come and to make their accusations against him at that place. So they had to travel from Jerusalem to Caesarea in order to do so. And that's where we get in our 24th chapter. So he's taken by the commander under this guard to Caesarea Maritima, which is what means maritime. And there are a bunch of Caesareas, as we've mentioned, but this one is on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea there in the region of Judah. And that particular place is where he was taken and held again for the next couple of years. But ostensibly at this point in time was held there by Felix until he could hear the matter. And he said, first of all, as we'll see in here, listen to the Sanhedrin, what they had to say. And he listened to what they had to say. He listened to Paul's defense. And then he waited for Lysias to come to him and hear from him too. Then he would decide the matter, which of course he did not, even though he promised to do so. So it's kind of where we're going to get in our discussion of the 24th chapter. So let's start off there. And let's begin by reading, you'll notice it's down to verses 2 through 9. So let's go with verses 1 through 9 of Matthew chapter 24 to begin our time together. We're told after 5 days that Ananias the high priest came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullus. So this is the command that was given. I'll hear you when your accusers have come and kept him in the praetorium until they were able to come down. Well, 5 days later, they received those in the Sanhedrin. It included, this delegation included the high priest himself, down with the elders and a certain orator. So an orator was given. I'm interested in these kinds of things in part. Again, you look at the political seasons and all, but one of the things that we see with regard to our candidates is in order for an individual to be a successful candidate for president, one of the primary things is for them to be a very good orator. And you'll see individuals, and it typically happens, I'm not saying that Biden or Trump are good orators. Josh kind of rolled his eyes a little bit, and I understand that there are exceptions to it, but Obama, for example, and Reagan and others, they were very good with words, and they were very interesting to individuals and charismatic, and that had an impact. But you'll see just about every year, every 4 years, whenever there is an election for the president, especially, that you'll have individuals who are senators and individuals who are congressmen and individuals who are governors, and they may be very astute individuals. But when you listen to them, they're not very charismatic. They're just kind of dry or perhaps they have too good of solutions to the problems and they're too complex and people just don't want to listen to them. And often that very thing is something that keeps them from being seriously considered as president. Now, I'm not saying, again, I don't want to say about every president being a good orator. It's not the point. The point is here that the high priest was there with all of his authority. The elders were all there, but they chose a man to speak for them. And this man was referred to as an orator. And so he was a speaker. He was an individual, had a way with words. And the point of it all was for him to be able to persuade Felix to hear and to believe and to accept their side of the issue. It's a very, very partisan statement that he gives here on this occasion. But let's listen to what Tertullus said here. And listen to the partisan nature of it and see the efforts that were made to basically sway Felix. So you'll start off there in verse 2. And he starts off with flattery to the governor. He said, "Seeing that through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity in being brought to this nation by your foresight, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from us. We have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. But the commander Lysias came by, and with great violence he took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you. And by examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him." And the Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so. And so, basically, they were saying, yeah, what he says is actually the way it happened. But I do want you to note that there is some truth in all of this. There is some. That's typical of just about everyone you'll hear. You've heard the phrase, statistics don't lie, but statisticians do. and the same thing with regard to this concept of partisanship and of coloring in order to gain some acceptance or gain the preeminence or prominence of your position that you're taking. And this guy was very, very good about this. And it is typically a mixture of some lies and some truth. And again, political too. It's very, very core. First of all, you'll note the question here is to characterize the speech. So I'm characterizing it somewhat. But what do you want to add to that with regard to characterizing the speech that was made that we just read to Felix? So we'll say political, partisan, possibly. What's contained within it? Okay, let me ask you a question with regard to this this particular speech. Would you categorize how Tertullus approached Felix, that he was praising him or flattering him?
Yeah.
Okay, that was two different things, though. And that's a distinction I made from my sermons, but it may not have come real close here. Okay, if you praise someone, that means that's legitimate. You are praising. I mean, we praise what each other individuals from time to time. Do you think Tertullus really had that respect for a Roman governor that it sounds like he has here? Of course not. So it's flattery. They're trying to get him on their side. And that's what typically flattery is. It's typical that it's insincere. Sometimes it is not true at all. But it was something that flattery. And then in regard to that, what about, we said there's some deceit that is found in the address. So what are the deceitful things that he said? So let's start off by saying, verse 5, we found this man a plague. Okay, is it true that he was a plague? Okay. Now, it may be true that we found him to be a plague, but that was because they weren't doing as they should, instead of Paul not doing as he should, wasn't it? Okay, so he is a creator of dissension. What did Paul say about that? Was that true or not? No, the dissension was not created by him. You remember what, I don't know if I've mentioned this a number of times, but there's an old saying that I'm sure it wasn't just to him or from him or originated from him, but Tom Roberts used to say, and Bobby Holmes, I don't remember which said it first, but who split the log? And it's, there is division that exists, but whose fault is it? And that's something to keep in mind. If I say something to you and it's truth, and you don't like it, and you argue with me, and there's a split caused in the church, who caused the split? Who caused the division? It's not the one who's speaking the truth. It's the individual who doesn't accept what the truth is. And there are a lot of individuals that don't understand that today. And so if someone has the audacity to speak the truth, maybe even to name names in order to warn the brethren about certain things or certain issues, or accurately represents it, and it causes division, they'll be accused of being the one fomenting the strife. If you would just keep quiet about these things, or if you wouldn't make these things a hobby, or you wouldn't be so forthright in stating these things, then we wouldn't be divided. And there may be truth. It wouldn't be divided, but the truth wouldn't be contended for either and defended. And Paul, of course, on this occasion was having to defend himself. So the creator of dissension, no, he was not throughout the Jews. And then he was a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Is that correct or not? Is it? Not technically. But at the same time, there's some truth in it, isn't it? Because what they did is consider Christianity a sect. They thought that it was an offshoot of Jewish religion, Judaism. And as a result of that, they, because they didn't approve of it, they didn't believe that Jesus was the Christ, and that's what the sect of the Nazarene, that has reference to Jesus being from Nazareth and known as the Nazarene. But he is a ringleader. Well, the Apostle Paul was maybe the preeminent spokesman at that point in time with regard to the accomplishments of his missionary journeys, all the churches that he started and such. Call him as an apostle a ringleader is not flattering, but it's not something that is necessarily inaccurate. And so, if you perceive, have you heard it? Because it's been told. I forget now who I recently heard it, but that we are as a congregation and as a church, the Lord's church, the Church of Christ, considered a sect or considered a cult. Did you know that? There are a lot, and why do people think that? Well, because we don't ascribe to salvation by faith alone. When in the beginning of the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s, the majority of religious people began to state that we're saved by faith only because of Martin Luther and other preeminent Protestant reformers. Now, if you do not take that position that you are saved by faith alone, then you are considered a part of a cult. A cult of works, and that's a misrepresentation of us. But in it is in some place accurate that we do not believe in faith only. But the idea that we're cultic, or the idea that as a result of not believing salvation by faith only, we have the only other alternative to be taken is that we're saved by merited works. Then that's an inaccuracy. It's just not true, but it has a little basis in truth, doesn't it? Which is why it is so effective in the world. Now, then verse 6, he tried to profane the temple, and we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. Did he actually profane the temple? No. And no one saw him profane the temple, didn't he? Did they? And that's why there are no eyewitnesses, which is a part of the answer of Paul. Then, let's go to verse 7. The commander Lysias came by and with great violence took him out of our hands. Is that an accurate representation of what happened? Lysias was keeping peace, wasn't he? Which is what his plan, what his responsibility was, and protecting a Roman citizen as well. And so that's not exactly what they said. Of course, he didn't know the Roman citizen at the time, but the point is that Lysias was doing exactly what Felix would have him to do. And it's an interesting thing afterwards when they gave their response or their narrative, and then Paul gave his response. The next thing that Felix wanted to know, what does Lysias have to say about this? Now, he'd already received the letter that we talked about earlier, but he wanted to hear more from Lysias to make his final determination. So he's not going to accept what the Jews have to say about this and about how bad a person Lysias was and how he abused his authority without talking to Lysias first. Pretty ineffective speech in a sense, but it was positioning their particular idea or narrative. Yes, Dennis?
The last thing we heard from the Jews at the Sanhedrin before this meeting that we're discussing now is when there was a tumult between the Sadducees and Pharisees. And the Pharisees actually said, "We find no evil in this man."
Yep.
But in the spirit of an angel that spoke, there was no fight against God. That's the last thing we heard from the Pharisees.
I think so too. I think that's exactly right. He wasn't going to deal with it right then. But yeah, I think that's exactly true. And the interesting thing about this too, when the description is given of those who came down, we are told they came with the high priest himself as well as the elders. And if you are familiar with Jewish history, especially at this particular time, and the Sanhedrin, it was primarily made up of Sadducees. And I just wonder with regard to this, with regard to the elders, the statement of the elders, and with the high priest, if it were not almost exclusively, if not exclusively, Sadducees that had this problem. Because when the Apostle Paul made reference to it, he made reference to the resurrection of the dead and his appeal to the resurrection as being the one thing that is the sticking point, which the Pharisees, of course, were in agreement with him upon. So it is, I think, interesting, and most probably this was a contingent of Sadducees that had come down here to make this address to the governor. Yes?
These Sadducees were a really strange lot. I've never been able to really wrap my mind around them. What they actually believe. I did a little reading on them, very little reading, and found out that the only thing they accepted, and they had a rather short run, 200 years before Christ took Paul about that. The only thing they believed was the Torah, the five books of the law, and they thought that was the only one that God wrote, and they wouldn't accept anything after that. The Torah doesn't mention resurrection. It does mention angels, but they don't believe it yet. It doesn't believe the afterlife, explain the afterlife. That's why they discounted all of that. So they obviously believe in God, they believe in the Torah. So all they had to live for was the power of the hand.
That's exactly
nothing
right.
Nothing else in their life. Because when they die, they will be dead like me.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, and that's a typical of just about every leader that you find in the world today, whether it's secular or religious, but not believing in the resurrection. So there's a lot of that's today. But you're right. And one of the reasons why I think the Sadducees as a sect were the most influential politically and the ones that were seeking after the power is because their desire was to gain glory here on earth because that's all that there was. And when I've kind of looked at it and equated it, there are two real extremes that come here. So you've got a group of It wouldn't be the same as modernists today, but you would have a group that were very much materialists at the very least. All they were concerned with is consolidating their time there on earth and being the leader of God's nation. But then you had the Pharisees who were not only accepting the Torah and other aspects of the law, but they were erecting their own tradition. So they kind of went to the other extreme, to where they were the ultra-conservative, ultra-orthodox individuals in many ways, and yet they became liberal in the sense that they were adding to God's Word. So their traditions and their inclination to add things to the law and all made them somewhat liberal in their thinking as well, I guess, but which is what was condemned by Christ when he got to them. But they were two very different groups, and that's all it would take, is that discussion of the resurrection, as we've seen on a number of occasions, because it was a preeminent position of the Sadducees, and it was adamantly opposed by the Pharisees. And this is a part of the conflict that existed here on this particular occasion. So the things that we've covered, I think, are up here on the board: the brazen flattery to Felix, the false charges against Paul, the misrepresentations of Lysias. They didn't really have an effect. And it is seen, I think, in a couple of things. The first one is the willingness of the governor to have Paul answer for himself. And then secondly, with regard to calling for Lysias to come. You'll notice in verse 22, when Felix heard these things, having a more accurate knowledge of the way, he adjourned the proceedings and said, "When Lysias the commander comes down, I'll make a decision on your case." And I think the decision, is, as Dennis has indicated, was already made at this point in time. But that doesn't mean that he was going to let Paul go. And that's, again, the part of politics. And we'll see here that while these individuals wanted to consolidate power, wanted to get rid of Paul, were angry at what his teaching was, the governor was an evil man. And he let Paul stay in prison for a couple of years just to please himself. It had nothing to do with his guilt or innocence or how Felix thought about it. It was simply to please Felix. And so we'll get into that in just a moment. So any comments, questions, more about this first address by Tertullus or the events? Okay, then we get into the second part of it, which will start in verses 10 and go down through verse 21, and that is Paul's defense, which is likewise something that is significant that we do need to read. We're told that Paul, after the governor had nodded for him to speak, answered and said, "Inasmuch as I know you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself," okay? "Because you may ascertain it is no more than 12 days." So I want you to just note, first of all, his address. Was it respectful? Yes, it was respectful, wasn't it? Okay? Was it sincere? Although there wasn't any desire to flatter him, was there? It was an acknowledgement of his authority, okay? And so sometimes that's sufficient praise that can be offered. Okay, you're the one that I need to answer to, so I'm willing to talk to you. That's basically what he was saying. But he didn't spend his time trying to flatter the governor like Tertullus did. And I think that's, again, an interesting contrast that we can give between what was typical in the day with regard to the men, the attempts at flattery that were insincere in order to gain advantage, and then the willingness of Paul to basically speak the truth, whether or not it cost him or if it gained him the release that he was seeking. And we'll see this in the next couple of weeks as well. Paul spoke the truth. He spoke it plainly. Sometimes it benefited him, sometimes it didn't. On this occasion, I think, because of the predilection of the governor, it was something that was somewhat of benefit in that, again, it was his desire to go to Rome and testify in Rome, as he had been told he was going to be able to do. And it allowed him to be separated from the Jewish judgment, which would be death or an attempt at death, again, as we alluded to last week, and into this Roman system, which may or may not bring him justice in life. Philippians chapter 1 tells us he didn't know what was going to happen for sure, but at the very least would accomplish his desire to go to Rome and to testify of the Lord in that particular occasion. So he said, "I'll answer to you for myself, and you will ascertain," first of all, this all happened in 12 days. a plague on our nation, and all these accusations made. It's only been 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship. They didn't find me in the temple disputing with anyone or inciting the crowd. So these were, again, the false accusations that were raised. He was causing strife. He was causing seditious actions. He was causing dissension. He wasn't doing it all. Now, again, he taught, certainly, but on this occasion when they're saying he was trying to rile up people in the temple and cause a problem, there's nothing true about that, in the temple, either in the synagogues or in the city, and they can't prove the things of which they now accuse me. So there's no proof, first of all. And there was. There was just the address by Tertullus. No witnesses were given about what he supposedly did because there were no witnesses that saw anything. There were some false accusations made, but no witnesses. He said, now, in verse 14, this I confess to you. So this is where he is not going to try to flatter and hold off the truth that might change what Felix has to say about him. He's simply going to put it out there because it was the truth. He said, I confess to you that according to the way which they call a sect, wasn't admitting it was a sect, but he said, that way that you're talking about, that they call the sect, I worship the God of my fathers and believe all things which are written in the law and in the prophets, and I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And this being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men. Now after many years I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation, in the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with a mob nor with tumult. And they ought to have been here before you to object if they had anything against me. So there are no eyewitnesses to what the claim was made. Or else, let those who are here themselves say if they found any wrongdoing in me. Do they have some evidence other than the oration of Tertullus to supply? And then in verse 21, this is the one thing. And that is, it is for this one statement which I cried out standing among them. Remember, this is the one that called the tumult between the Pharisees and the Sadducees concerning the resurrection of the dead. I am being judged by you this day. Now, this is kind of an interesting thing. So, look at verse 15. I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and of the unjust. And then he goes down in verse 21 and says, I'm being judged for this statement that I believe in the resurrection of the dead, and my hope is in the resurrection. So, does anyone want to try to make an effort as to how to rationalize these two statements that seem somewhat to be contradictory? At least it seemed to me to be somewhat contradictory. Do they profess? Does the Sanhedrin profess to have a hope based upon the resurrection of the dead? What are we told in chapter 23? That he spoke about it and they were divided, right? So some do, some don't. Okay? So he's bringing it up again, isn't he? The same basic thing. So now in regard to this, there's no indication of a dispute. This is one of the reasons I think perhaps there were not Pharisees here. But he wanted to bring it up again. He wanted it to be known that this is the basis of this contention that is had. And then what happened if Lysias would say, well, what's the proof of this? Resurrection from the dead. What could Paul do? He could go to the law. And he could make reference to the resurrection and those arguments that the Pharisees accepted, which would cause division in the Sanhedrin and would put the Sadducees on the spot. You believe these verses or not? And then they would have to have said, no, that doesn't apply. But these points that are being made here, basically, this is what caused the division, which really put some on his side, but caused others to dispute it and want him to be put to death in regard to it, and that is the resurrection. So, he makes acknowledgement of the fact that there are certain things that they said about me that are true. But the claims that are made about unlawful activities that would be judged or could be judged by the old law, I didn't do it, and I'm willing to have people stand before me and accuse me of it because it's simply not so. Where are they? Concerning the other stuff, I've got my answers. And that's basically what was true. And it just shows the silliness of the arguments that were made in the illegitimacy of them. Now, looking at our society today, do illegitimate arguments sometimes have merit in the eyes of some? Of course they do. And I could give you examples and my views about these things with regard to what's going on now with our present election cycle and such. But isn't that the case? Isn't that what partisanship is, primarily? You know, if it's my guy, nothing that he has done which may be insidious and wrong is something that is, number one, convictable. Number two, illegal in any way. And number three, I really don't think he probably did it. And if he did, he has to have a good explanation. Whereas in the other case, the worst motives are always placed upon the other guy, and the government is sicked on the other guy, whoever it is. And it's kind of a funny thing because we've got two flawed presidential candidates who are both being treated that way by each party. My party hates your guy, your party hates my guy, and we're gonna do the best for our guy and the worst for your guy. And that's kind of what was being done here. Paul's the worst. And so everything that Paul did had a bad, bad connotation in their mind, and they were going to give the worst case scenario about it. And what Paul was saying is, prove it, number one. And number two, the few things that you spoke to me about that are not accurate but have some truth to it, let me explain. And he was able to explain it away. But whether it be accepted or not was depending upon the whim of those who are listening. Because truth is not always accepted by everyone. Yes, Justin.
So there's nothing new under the sun, and all very similar. And also similar is that the majority of people around didn't care.
Yep.
The vast majority of people living in Israel didn't care a little bit about the Pharisees and the Sadducees and their disagreements and things like that.
That's true. But that is an interesting thing that while they're saying that was Felix's idea and such, and they were being ineffectual, they're still trying their very best to keep some cohesiveness to their little fiefdom, you know, it was important just to them, and as was indicated, but no one else did have. I remember going when I went to Chorazin. There in the Bible lands, there is a ritual bath there. And one of the things that Mike Willis, when he was talking to us about the what it was and the different things, it was a tradition of the Pharisees that no one else in the land had time for. You know, they had this, you know, these rich people or these better off people, and they would sit there, and he said, just imagine them sitting here at this ritual bath, and people are walking by, and them just demeaning others who did not take the time to ritually bathe and all of these kinds of things, and the rest of the people just didn't have time for it. They had their lives to live, and you could even see that somewhat with regard to Jesus walking by, how they would look askance at Jesus, and this was their own tradition that had been established. It wasn't anything that was required, but they built it all up and they made it important. It gave them that position of importance and significance in their own minds. But everyone else just let them go, and so we see a lot of that, and you see that today. Again, we're making parallels. You can see the same kind of thing happens, although it may be less of the religious slant, and more of the other. But you hear about the flyover country. It's the same type of thing. You know, what counts is in the Beltline there in Washington D.C. What counts is on the coasts, and what doesn't count is everybody else that lives in between that they fly over and don't even see, and it's not relevant to some people. Some people don't care, and It's true. There are an awful lot of people that don't care about them either. And it's just kind of going on and going on. So that kind of thing is just the human condition. And that's what I wanted to point out here in this lesson, is you see a lot of the human condition. So the question is, what was Paul guilty of any of the charges? Not really, was he? Either false charges or distorted charges in that regard. So he explained it very clearly in verses 12 through 13. So with that in mind, we get to the next section. And the affirmation in verses 14 through 21 are mentioned here with regard to his affirmation that he was a Christian. This is the one thing that I'm guilty of. But the question is, what was the reason for Paul's imprisonment, as stated in verse 21 of the text? Ultimately, why was he there? Or a big part of it?
Resurrection.
I really think that's what's consideration. Now, again, it was their perceiving their power, and that was a side issue of that kind of stuff, but it really is something that was important. And it is important with regard to other aspects of our faith. You look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, for example, when there were some in Corinth that didn't believe in the resurrection. So they were tacitly denying the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and he said, that's problematic. It is problematic. Anyone who would deny the resurrection has a problem. And we don't have hope as a result of that. So I wouldn't say this is the only thing, the only issue, but he does acknowledge that it's the only thing that he is willing to say is something I did that they claim I did. In other words, there are people who are witnesses who said that they didn't like what I had to say about the resurrection. And so that was the only thing that was legitimate. He said, unless, that's the one thing. Maybe it is because I cried out standing among them concerning the resurrection of the dead, I'm being judged by you this day. Wasn't really wrongdoing, I wouldn't say, but it certainly was something that applied in regard to it. That may have been a somewhat misleading question, because I can't say that for certain that was, certainly wasn't the only thing, but it was the one issue that Paul said, if I'm being judged by this, that's legitimate. I did say that. And so that's the point that's been made. Yes, Dennis.
Just a little bit, another thing that caused this continual argument was Jesus' grief.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that.
That's where we're getting to.
But the one thing I think is really interesting, they were not pulling the wool over his eyes. Because the very next verse says that Felix had a more accurate knowledge of the way. Perhaps it's his Jewish wife that kept him, he knew more about what was going on than these Pharisees thought he did. But he had already had a good understanding of it, already knew who Paul was. But he did not buy our paper.
No, not at all. I think that Paul maybe opened his eyes on a few things too in his address. Yeah. See, that's good. Okay, let's get to the final, I don't know if this is the final, yeah, it's three questions, so we'll have to go through it quickly. But the final section is found in verses 22 through 27. Felix heard these things, and he said, when Lysias the commander comes down, I will make a decision on your case. And he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty and told him not to forbid any friends to provide for or visit him. So this is same basic kind of house arrest, same kind of thing where many liberties were given to Paul, so he wasn't thrown in stocks in the inner prison like Peter like Paul and Silas were done in Acts 16. But after some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish. He sent for Paul, heard him concerning his faith in Christ. And as he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and answered, go away now. When I come for a convenient time, I'll call you. Meanwhile, he also hoped that money would be given him by Paul, that he might release him, and therefore he sent for him more often and conversed with him. But after 2 years that Paul was in his care, Porcius Festus succeeded Felix, and Felix, wanting to do the Jews a favor, you know, the political aspect to it, he left Paul bound. And so for 2 years, even though Paul, and he knew Paul had done nothing wrong, he left him. So let's look at the three questions, and then if we've got time, maybe a point. Felix promised to make the final decision. Did he keep the promise? No, he didn't, did he? He delayed for 2 years and was replaced. Characterize the response of Felix to Paul in verse 25 of the text. What two things characterize Felix's response?
Afraid.
Fear is one. What's the other? Have you heard of the procrastination of Felix? Go away now. And when I have convenient time, I'll call for you. That's procrastination, isn't it? So that's the two things that I wanted to make note of. He procrastinated, and there's no indication that the time ever came for him to respond. Although he reasoned about temperance and judgment, and he had things to say that actually caused Felix to be afraid. So these words had some kind of impact. Now, whether it's fleeting, you can't imagine a governor just being afraid of a boogeyman tale. So it must be that there's some indication that Felix thought that this may be so. Perhaps it was the influence of his Jewish wife. It was the eloquence and the power of the truth and the eloquence of Paul. But Felix was, it bothered him. But he didn't want to do anything about it right then. And so he said, go away. And then, of course, the third question that is involved in this is his hope in keeping Paul imprisoned was what?
Money.
Very crass motivation, but that's it. He hoped to be bribed by Paul and to extort money from him so that he would, in exchange, release Paul, which there's no indication he necessarily would have done it, but he wanted money in that hope that Paul would have that hope that he would be released. Yes, then.
2 Corinthians 5:11. Paul wrote, knowing therefore the terror of the Lord, we persuade men. Paul was a persuading new life.
Oh, yes, he did.
And we see he was put into the
he was. Yeah, and that becomes evident when we talk about Festus and Agrippa as well. Yeah, we're going to get into this. This is an amazing thing. Look at his addresses during this period of time, and it shows a little bit of why Paul was so successful in his efforts to establish churches and evangelize the lost there in that first century. How good he was at it. Do keep in mind, though, the danger of procrastination. I just want to use this point again. That Felix, he said, when I have a more convenient season, I'll call for you. And that convenient season, we have no indication at all ever came. And we can't have that same idea when it comes to understanding that there is a judgment. That which causes fear in us, that fear may not last. But as the fear is there, we should act upon it. In the acknowledgement that indeed what he said is true. So keep that in mind. We'll pick up with chapter 25 in our study next time. I appreciate your kind attention today.